Chapter 10. Have I the privilege of addressing the distinguished author of Fast and Loose? If so, let me thank you in the name of the Women Psychological League of Peoria for your magnificent courage in raising the standard of revolt against. You can tell us the rest in the car, said a fat man, pressing his good-humored bulk against the speaker's arm. Mrs. Fetherell, blushing, embarrassed and happy, slipped into the space produced by this displacement, and a few moments later had taken her seat in the train. She was a little late, and the other chairs were already filled by a company of elderly ladies and clergymen who seemed to belong to the same party, and were still busy exchanging greetings and settling themselves in their places. One of the ladies, at Mrs. Fetherell's approach, uttered an exclamation of pleasure and advanced with outstretched hand. My dear Mrs. Fetherell, I am so delighted to see you here. May I hope you are going to the unveiling of the chantry window? The dear bishop so hoped that you would do so. But perhaps I ought to introduce myself. I am Mrs. Gollinger. She lowered her voice expressively. Knee of your uncle's oldest friends, one who has stood close to him through all this sad business, and who knows what he suffered when he felt obliged to sacrifice family affection to the call of duty. Mrs. Fetherell, who had smiled and colored slightly at the beginning of this speech, received its close with a deprecating gesture. Oh, pray don't mention it, she murmured. I quite understood how my uncle was placed. I bore him no ill will for feeling obliged to preach against my book. He understood that, and was so touched by it. He has often told me that it was the hardest task he was ever called upon to perform, and, do you know, he quite feels that this unexpected gift of the chantry window is in some way a return for his courage in preaching that sermon. Mrs. Fetherell smiled faintly. Does he feel that? Yes, he really does. When the funds for the window were so mysteriously placed at his disposal, just as he had begun to despair of raising them, he assured me that he could not help connecting the fact with his denunciation of your book. Dear uncle, sighed Mrs. Fetherell. Did he say that? And now, continued Mrs. Gollinger, with cumulative rapture, that you are about to show, by appearing at the ceremony today, that there has been no break in your friendly relations, the dear bishop's happiness will be complete. He was so longing to have you come to the unveiling. He might have counted on me, said Mrs. Fetherell, still smiling. That is so beautifully forgiving of you, cried Mrs. Gollinger, enthusiastically. But then, the bishop has always assured me that your real nature was very different from that which, if you will pardon my saying so, seems to be revealed by your brilliant, but rather subversive book. If you only knew my niece, dear Mrs. Gollinger, apostrophe he always said, you would see that her novel was written in all innocence of heart, apostrophe, and to tell you the truth, when I first read the book I didn't think it so very, very shocking. It was until the dear bishop had explained, Tom, but, dear me, I mustn't take up your time in this way when so many others are anxious to have a word with you. Mrs. Fetherell glanced at her in surprise, and Mrs. Gollinger continued, with a playful smile, colon, you forget that your face is familiar to thousands whom you have never seen. We all recognized you the moment you entered the train, and my friends here are so eager to make your acquaintance, even though her smile deepened. Oh, thought the dear bishop, not quite unjustified in his attack on your remarkable novel. A religious light filled the chantry of Ossining Cathedral, filtering through the linen curtain which veiled the central window, and mingling with the blaze of tapers on the richly adorned altar. In this devout atmosphere, agreeably laden with the incense-like aroma of Easter lilies and forced lilacs, Mrs. Fetherell knelt with a sense of luxurious satisfaction. Beside her sat Archer Hines, who had remembered that there was to be a church scene in his next novel, and that his impressions of the devotional environment needed refreshing. Mrs. Fetherell was very happy. She was conscious that her entrance had sent a thrill through the female devotees who packed the chantry, and as he had humor enough, to enjoy the thought that, but for the good bishop's denunciation of her book, the heads of his flock would not have been turned so eagerly in her direction. Moreover, as S.E. had entered, S.E. had caught sight of a society reporter, and she knew that her presence, and the fact that she was accompanied by Hines, would be conspicuously proclaimed in the morning papers. All these evidences of the success of her handiwork might have turned a calmer head than Mrs. Fetherell's, and though she had now learned to dissemble her gratification, it still filled her inwardly with a delightful glow. The bishop was somewhat late in appearing, and she employed the interval in meditating on the plot of her next novel, which was already partly sketched out, but for which S.E. had been unable to find a satisfactory denouement. By a not uncommon process of ratiocination, Mrs. Fetherell's success had convinced her of her vocation. She was sure now that it was her duty to lay bare the secret plague spots of society, and she was resolved that there should be no doubt as to the purpose of her new book. Experience had shown her that, whereas he had fancied she was calling a spade as he had in fact been alluding in guarded terms to the drawing-room shovel. She was determined not to repeat the same mistake, and she flattered herself that her coming novel would not need an episcopal denunciation to ensure its sale, however likely it was to receive this crowning evidence of success. S.E. had reached this point in her meditations when the choir burst into song, and the ceremony of the unveiling began. The bishop, almost always felicitous in his addresses to the fair sex, was never more so than when he was celebrating the triumph of one of his cherished purposes. There was a peculiar mixture of Christian humility and episcopal exultation in the manner with which he called attention to the Creator's promptness in responding to his demand for funds, and he had never been more happily inspired than in eulogizing the mysterious gift of the chantry window. Though no hint of the donor's identity had been allowed to escape him, it was generally understood that the bishop knew who had given the window, and the congregation awaited in a flutter of suspense the possible announcement of a name. None came, however, though the bishop deliciously titillated the curiosity of his flock by circling ever closer about the interesting secret. He would not disguise from them, he said, that the heart which had divined his inmost wish had been a woman's, is it not to woman's intuitions, that more than half the happiness of earth is owing? What man is obliged to learn by the laborious process of experience, woman's wondrous instinct tells her at a glance, and so it had been with this cherished scheme, this unhoped-for completion of their beautiful chantry. So much, at least, he was allowed to reveal. And indeed, had he not done so, the window itself would have spoken for him, since the first glance at its touching subject and exquisite design would show it to have originated in a woman's heart. This tribute to the sex was received with an audible sigh of contentment, and the bishop, always stimulated by such evidence of his sway over his hearers, took up his theme with gathering eloquence. Yes, a woman's heart had planned the gift, a woman's hand had executed it, and, might he add, without too far withdrawing the veil in which Christian beneficence ever loved to drape its acts, might he add that, under Providence, a book, a simple book, a mere tale in fact, had had its share in the good work for which they were assembled to give thanks? At this unexpected announcement, a ripple of excitement ran through the assemblage, and more than one head was abruptly turned in the direction of Mrs. Fetherell, who sat listening in an agony of wonder and confusion. It did not escape the observant novelist at her side that she drew down her veil to conceal an uncontrollable blush, and this evidence of dismay caused him to fix an attentive gaze on her, while from her seat across the aisle, Mrs. Gollinger sent a smile of unctuous approval. A book, a simple book, the bishop's voice went on above this flutter of mingled emotions. What is a book? Only a few pages and a little ink, and yet one of the mightiest instruments which Providence has devised for shaping the destinies of man. One of the most powerful influences for good or evil which the Creator has placed in the hands of his creatures. dot. The air seemed intolerably close to Mrs. Fetherell, and she drew out her scent bottle, and then thrust it hurriedly away, conscious that she was still the center of an unenviable attention. And all the while the bishop's voice droned on. Dot dot, and of all forms of literature, fiction is doubtless that which has exercised the greatest sway, for good or ill, over the passions and imagination of the masses. Yes, my friends, I am the first to acknowledge it. No sermon, however eloquent, no theological treatise, however learned and convincing, has ever inflamed the heart and imagination like a novel, a simple novel. Incalculable is the power exercised over humanity by the great magicians of the pen, a power ever enlarging its boundaries, and increasing its responsibilities as popular education multiplies the number of readers. Yes, it is the novelist's hand which can pour balm on countless human sufferings, or inoculate mankind with the festering poison of a corrupt imagination. Dot dot. Mrs. Fetherell had turned white, and her eyes were fixed with a blind stare of anger on the large-sleeved figure in the center of the chancel. And too often, alas, it is the poison, and not the balm which the unscrupulous hand of genius proffers to its unsuspecting readers. But, my friends, why should I continue? None know better than an assemblage of Christian women, such as I am now addressing, the beneficent or baleful influences of modern fiction. And so, when I say that this beautiful chantry window of ours owes its existence in part to the romancer's pen, the bishop paused, and bending forward, seemed to seek a certain face among the countenances eagerly addressed to his hand. I say that this pen, which for personal reasons it does not become me to celebrate unduly, Mrs. Fetherell at this point half rose, pushing back her chair, which scraped loudly over the marble floor. But Hines involuntarily laid a warning hand on her arm, and she sank down with a confused murmur about the heat. When I confess that this pen, which for once at least, has proved itself so much mightier than the sword, is that which was inspired to trace the simple narrative of Through a Glass Brightly, Mrs. Fetherell looked up with a gasp of mingled relief and anger, and I tell you, my dear friends, that it was your bishop's own work which first roused the mind of one of his flock to the crying need of a chantry window. I think you will admit that I am justified in celebrating the triumphs of the pen, even though it be the modest instrument which your own bishop wields. The bishop paused impressively, and a faint gasp of surprise and disappointment was audible throughout the chantry. Something very different from this conclusion had been expected, and even Mrs. Gollinger's lips curled with a slightly ironic smile. But Archer Hines' attention was chiefly reserved for Mrs. Fetherell, whose face had changed with astonishing rapidity from surprise to annoyance, from annoyance to relief, and then back again to something very like indignation. The address concluded, the actual ceremony of the unveiling was about to take place, and the attention of the congregation soon reverted to the chancel, where the choir had grouped themselves beneath the veiled window, prepared to burst into a chant of praise as the bishop drew back the hanging. The moment was an impressive one, and every eye was fixed on the curtain. Even Hines gazed straight to it for a moment, but soon returned to his neighbor's face. And then he perceived that Mrs. Fetherell, alone of all the persons present, was not looking at the window. Her eyes were fixed in an indignant stare on the bishop. A flush of anger burned becomingly under her veil, and her hands nervously crumpled the beautifully printed program of the ceremony. Hines broke into a smile of comprehension. He glanced at the bishop, and back at the bishop's niece. Then, as the Episcopal hand was solemnly raised to draw back the curtain, he bent and whispered in Mrs. Fetherell's ear. Why, you gave it yourself. You wonderful woman, of course you gave it yourself. Mrs. Fetherell raised her eyes to his with a start. Her blush deepened and her lips shaped a hasty O, but the denial was deflected into the indignant murmur, "He wasn't his silly book that did it anyhow." The lady's maid's bell, it was the autumn, after I had the typhoid. I'd been 3 months in hospital, and when I came out I looked so weak and tottery that the two or three ladies I applied to were afraid to engage me. Most of my money was gone, and after I'd boarded for 2 months, hanging about the employment agencies, and answering any advertisement that looked any way respectable, I pretty nearly lost heart, for fretting hadn't made me fatter, and I didn't see why my luck should ever turn. It did though, or I thought so at the time. A Mrs. Railton, a friend of the lady that first brought me out to the States, met me one day and stopped to speak to me. She was one that had always a friendly way with her. She asked me what ailed me to look so white, and when I told her, "Why, hardly," says she, "I believe I've got the very place for you. Come in tomorrow, and we'll talk about it." The next day, when I called, she told me the lady she'd in mind was a niece of hers, a Mrs. Brimpton, a youngish lady, but something of an invalid, who lived all the year round at her country place on the Hudson, owing to not being able to stand the fatigue of town life. "Now, hardly," Mrs. Railton said, in that cheery way that always made me feel things must be going to take a turn for the better, "I understand me. It's not a cheerful place I'm sending you to. The house is big and gloomy. My niece is nervous, vapourish. Her husband, well, he's generally away. And the two children are dead. A year ago, I would as soon have thought of shutting a rosy active girl like you into a vault, but you're not particularly brisk." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.